from the Sky News Centre at 5. Violence has spread further across Iraq as Islamist extremists take control of more parts of the country. Tom Howrigan has more.
Iraqi security forces are trying to stop the Sunni militants in Mosul in the north. But the UN says there's already been a heavy cost.
We've received reports of the summary execution of army soldiers.
More than 500,000 people have fled their homes. Nazar Ali's one of them.
I swear to God, the situation is terrible. Our normal life has been destroyed.
Iraqi troops are trying to protect the capital Baghdad from attack. The US Secretary of State wants a quick resolution.
We are laser focused on dealing with the crisis.
The most senior Shia cleric in Iraq has now called on ordinary people to take up arms.
A woman accused of killing her parents and burying them in their garden has told a court she lost it after being taunted by her mum. Susan Edwards, who admits manslaughter but denies murder, says she shot her mother after she claimed to have had an affair with her husband. Ford Open Prison in West Sussex says it's doing all it can to find 89 missing inmates, one of them serving a life sentence for armed robbery. Sussex MP Nick Gibb is concerned officials have been sending the wrong people there in the first place.
I'm worried about the risk assessment process. We need to make sure the right prisoners are being sent here, those at the end of their sentence who are being assessed as worthy of going to open conditions, ready for final release, and not prisoners who have, for example, absconded before.
Some face-to-face interviews of people applying for passports have been suspended as officials try to clear a huge backlog. The Home Office says it's routine and happened last summer too. Harrison Ford is still in hospital with a confirmed broken ankle. The actor had an accident on the set of the latest Star Wars movie. And in cricket, England's bowlers are finding it just as hard as Sri Lanka on day two of the first test at Lord's. A short while ago, the tourists were 86 for one. England declared on 575 for nine. That's the latest. I'm Anna Jones.
We are Bristol's first community radio station. BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday the 13th of June. It's 5 o'clock and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news, it's Labour Councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Lib Dem leader Nick Clegg is staying on till next May's general election. Well, it's surely only going to help the Tories. So is Clegg clinging on to his day in the sun for the Tories' sake? Has he not only ditched the electorate, but his own party's members too? With a new leader, with the blessing of the membership, Lib Dems stand a chance of holding office again. So, since everybody knows Clegg's a big turn-off for the voters, why not give one of the rising political stars a chance? This week we take a look at the Lib Dem leader, Nick Clegg, and ask, why is this albatross still running the party? Plus, the Tory party and Freemasonry. We reveal exclusively tonight that Western Town Council's former Tory mayor, Tory deputy leader of North Somerset Council, who just pleaded guilty to 12 counts of making and possession of child pornography, his name's Philip Judd. He is, or was until recently, a Freemason in Western Supermare's number 1222. That's 1222 St. Q Lodge, and he's due to be sentenced next month. What with the Freemasons hiding away in the police and the judiciary, it's a minor miracle the case came to court. Well done, everyone involved. But why is it mandatory for Masons to declare their Masonic membership over the Bristol Channel in Wales, but not here in England? Answer, because the Masons lobbied successfully and secretly for the abolition of something called the Standards Board of England. So we ask, what oaths does a Freemason swear to? And what does such a system of privilege and promotion of one's Masonic brothers above the rest of us do to a country? Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's 2 weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 21, a relatively sunny weekend. Next week, that's highs of 21 Celsius, a relatively sunny week, a few possible light showers. Next weekend, the 21st and 22nd of June, highs of 21 degrees and sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Labour Councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. Hi, Ron, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
First of all, Ron, what about the reshuffle within the Labour group on the City Council? Because you were Deputy Leader, weren't you, but you're not anymore. So who is in the new roles, then?
Estelle Titnell.
Tell us a bit about her.
Well, she's a new councillor that was elected, not this time, but the previous election in Lockleys.
Now, we've also had Derek Pickup, I think his name was, who was on the show a few months ago, saying, well, there seems to be a move within the Labour group to get rid of older people with experience and put in the new blood. Is that something? Because, I mean, you know, you're an older person.
I'm 71,
You have been shuffled sideways. You're no longer the deputy leader. They're bringing younger people in.
Well, there is a move, and obviously, you have to admit that... you do need change and a mix-up, and it's not fair on new councillors that, it's the same group of people. I stood in the election on the basis of what I did last year. The party decided to accept Estelle. Well, that's politics. It's a horse you ride and you fall off and you get back on and carry on. I'm not worried about it because the only title I need is councillor for St George West, and what I will be doing is what I've done for the last 29 years without a break, and that is I will be defending my ward. I will be doing everything I can for the residents of it, and if I think things are wrong, whether it's us or anybody else, I should be out there and saying so. I've never been frightened to make my own opinion. And I've spoken out against my own Labour group in the past. And, I've eventually been found to be right. And the policy that they were following was incorrect. So nothing changes.
OK. What are the issues that you're dealing with at the moment then, Ron? You say you're constantly fighting with various, for your constituents in various ways. What? Give us an example, something recent.
Well, take Meadow Vale on the Speedwell estate. It's got a community centre that was a rundown building and used to store the grass mowing machines. And the building is far too small. I mean, it's far smaller than virtually this studio that was sat in, and a much lower ceiling. And so the building limits the number of people and what can go on in it. And so we've been working with UE students in over the last few months on a new design concept for it, an extension, and working up a bid process for national grant applications or indeed lottery funding to be able to give the Speedwell estate a proper community centre that is socially inclusive and able to take on virtually anything and work in conjunction with the nursery.
Is that going to happen?
It's happening. We've finished the design concept. We've got the bid process and booklet ready for anybody that wants to read it. We've got a complete model made to scale of what we want to do, and we're processing that rapidly. The other thing, of course, is keeping on track with the City Council, the ability to restore a swimming pool in East Bristol.
Well, yeah, I mean, you mentioned swimming pools. I think immediately of Speedwell Pool. What on earth is happening with that? It's a beautiful purpose-built pool in the middle of a load of allotments, and it's been derelict for how long?
8 years. That wasn't our decision. We were in control of the council. That was the Liberal Democrats in an election, found that they had a problem in Eastern Pool, and so decided to shut somebody else's on a full set of data. And so we've been without it for 8 years.
Well, tell us the story of that, because whenever I see something like that, I think this is a criminal shame. This is public money that's been put into building that place.
Yeah.
It could be a fantastic facility for thousands, if not tens of thousands of people in the catchment area for a pool.
Yeah.
It's purpose-built for it, with only two or three staff, maybe a couple of lifeguards, someone on the gate to take the money, that sort of thing, a cleaner. You know, that would be a brilliant facility, but it's not. It's just boarded up. I mean, why on earth is that not available?
Well, the thing was, it was shut on the basis that when the costings for remodelling and updating was gone into, it was found that Speedwell was actually cheaper to do it than the issues they had with a jerry-built ceiling in the Eastern Pool. And so as it's an election period, they had to find out, and the costing was done on per head of user. And so instead of just keeping to the swimmers, they included everybody in the dry keep fit centre and gym. And so Speedwell lost out, and I went to the Ombudsman, and he agreed it was an unfair comparison, but the Ombudsman, as you probably know, can't change a decision. And then in that case, with all the pressures and cuts that's gone on, the site was sold off, and it's in the hands of a developer, and a number of developers have come up with proposals on that site, none of which has come to fruition, and it's sitting there rotting.
Well, that's just appalling, isn't it? I mean, you know, particularly since the public money that went into it in the first place. I'm guessing that it was built in the 1950s or something.
Correct, yeah.
So
about 52, I think.
Let's think about, what can be done about that, Ron. Is that in your patch, that particular pool?
Yeah. Well, the pool isn't. It's just in Hillfields because it's on the other side of Speedwell Road. But the Will and Driving initiative is coming from the Labour councillors in both Hillfield, St George East and St George West.
But surely it's out of the council's hands now, it's been sold off. It's like, well, out of sight, out of mind, isn't it? It's like, well, it's nothing to do with us. But of course, the council still could have a role in granting planning permission. Do you know what these developers have been saying should happen on the site? Would it be still a pool? Operated as a
No, it would be a private development, almost certainly be housing of some description. And that's what the last application was about. But it's
always housing nowadays, isn't it? Everything that gets sold off. But whether it's a pub. Actually, no pubs. Sometimes it's a Tesco Express in there. But almost everything now is going for housing. Everything that's being closed down.
Well, what you've got to remember is that there's 10,000 homes that have been granted planning permission, outline planning permission, by the City Council, waiting to be built within the city boundary, and none of them have put a brick on a brick because the developers are playing the market and playing the price brackets, and that is a disgrace.
And when you say playing the markets, just explain how it can possibly be good for a developer and make them more money to not build anything.
Well, what you get is if house prices go up...
Which they are quite amazing.
Yes, and they're going up on a fairly steady curve at the minute. If you buy a site, right, it's obviously got a base value, but that base value is enhanced when you put in an outline planning permission for, say, 50 homes, okay?
Right, this is the land value you're talking about, essentially, isn't it?
The
land
and the value of the site. But what you do is wait for a point in that rising curve, and you then sell on the land with planning application outlined for 50 homes, and that profit, because it will cost more for the next potential developer to take it on, is what they actually pocket.
Right. So it really is a lot of it. The ownership by these developers has really got nothing to do with actually developing the site.
No.
It's just got to do with hanging on to the land underneath the site to then sell it on at some later date for more money.
Yeah.
Okay, so they're not really, when we're calling them developers, they're not really developing anything. They're just sitting on its land. I think they call it land banking, don't they?
That's right.
Which always strikes me. If you get a developer land banking, then, you know, you've got the banksters and their banking combined with a developer is about probably the worst thing you could possibly be in the entire world. But anyway, I know you're quite passionate, as we are on this show, Ron, about housing. What's happening with sorting out the situation with homelessness in the city? Because, as we know, we're running around about 15,000 people on the homeless list.
Exactly.
We obviously need to make sure that those people are housed. How are we going to do that? We've had this scandal over the last week or so with the homelessness spikes being put in London to try and stop people rough sleeping who haven't got anywhere to live.
Yeah.
And I'm just hoping that those are not part of Mayor Ferguson's plan to house the homeless.
No, I know. There's a number of initiatives that can go on. I know one chap that's looking at a similar proposal to Brighton, They're using container homes, which are the cargo containers, but retrofitted.
Doesn't sound like much of a home to me. Might be in a
no,
container.
It doesn't.
Has it got a window?
Yes, it's got windows, and doors, and it's made ecologically sound, and it's obviously, you know, heaped made more comfortable in relation to cladding and all the rest of it.
God, well, it sounds like it might be quite cold as a metal box. It might, you know.
Well, yeah, I'm not 100% convinced by this because of the reasons you've given. I've got a better solution in my ward, actually, and that is the local company in Hannam that makes timber frame properties that are totally eco, 100%. And he started out building garden sheds, and he's gone into this. And he builds a beautiful one- or two-bedroom property.
Two-bedroom garden shed?
Yeah, he started off making wooden garden sheds, but he now makes timber frame property.
So tell us a bit about this chap. Is you know, what's the business?
Well, he's out on the Hannam trading estate. And he's
Do you know the name of the business?
I'm trying to think of it. It's a three... I think it's AJ something or other.
Okay, anyway, sorry, carry on.
Whatever. Anyway, what you get is something that doesn't look like a standard prefab or a cardboard box. It looks like any modern small home unit that you would find on any estate in Sadley Broke, Yate, or wherever, in Keynsham, for instance. Nicely finished, brilliantly fitted out, far better than the city council, and a one-bedroom unit for that is between £38,000 and £50,000, depending on what you have as a final finish, whether you go for solar panelling or whether you don't, and other issues. And it fits into the footprint in an average garden. And this family in Hudsvale Road, mum owns the house with no mortgage. Three of her family were on the waiting list. She's had one of these built. She moves into that. They move into the house, come off the waiting list, end of story. And that can be done from 24 hours to make the timber frame and 6 to 8 weeks from start to finish to build.
But
that's
sounds
the answer.
It sounds a little bit like the old prefabs, doesn't it? Post-war prefabs.
Yes, it is. It's on a similar issue to that. It's got a life expectancy of something like 70 years.
But the funny thing is, isn't it, the council has been selling off its prefab sites and selling those off.
I know. And this is what we, as part of the Labour Party's housing policy that I've written, is trying to actually get the council to re-look at. There's 85 sites in the city boundary that are extremely small, that major developers wouldn't take up. Naseby Walk, for example, in my ward, they pulled down the garages opposite the council house. You could get three of these units on there instead of growing nettles and brambles, and give three families a decent home. And it's cheap. By comparison to property, it's probably half or a third of the cost of the lowest properties that you see in Bristol. And it's the way forward. And they're eco and 100% eco-sound. Everything. Recycled rainwater, you know, the lot.
Okay,
beautifully
so
fitted.
Compare that to what Mayor Ferguson's plans are for housing the homeless in the city. Because I know before he was elected, we had quite an interesting debate here on BCFM about housing and housing the homeless. And there were lots of promises made. What's going on the ground?
Well, he's still... First of all, he didn't want to put a total to it. He gave a commitment to increasing it. Well, he didn't have to increase it much from the 12 that had been managed to be developed the previous year. What he's now put on is a total of 1,000 in the time that he's got left within the context up to 2016. That's still too few. And basically, the officers are working to that programme. But anything we can add to that, and I've been lobbying the housing department and the directors, etc., and they have agreed to come out and look at these new ideas from Hannam, etc. Because at one stage it was thought to be too good to be true. I've taken three of my colleagues out there who thought it was too good to be true, and all three of them are trying to buy one.
Okay.
All right.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. This is something we grapple with time and time again. It's lovely to have Ron here from the Labour Group, who's always been a bit of a campaigner on housing issues, trying to push the envelope a little bit. Well, what's your thoughts about actual solutions to the housing crisis? Because it's not getting any easier. House prices are going through the roof, quite literally. What was it? I think it was £3,000-4,000 in just in a month they were increasing in London the other day. Anyway, what are your thoughts about how to actually get roofs over the heads of people who are homeless? We've got 15,000 on the list in Bristol.
Well, I mean, the macroeconomic implications of having a crummy housing policy are awful. I mean, for decades we've actually got it wrong in this country, and we're now paying the price for it. This housing bubble that we've got now is probably going to wreck the economy. I mean, even George Osborne was talking about that last night in the Mansion House. Even people like he can see that this is no good.
Even Mark Carney was saying it's not good for the economy.
We've been here before, the Lawson boom, the Barber boom.
How does a housing bubble actually affect the economy in such a bad way?
Well, because what happened, because we haven't got a proper social housing policy in this country, and we haven't had one for donkey's years, including when we had Labour Party in power, it means that there's just insufficient supply, and therefore, as soon as the economy starts to pick up, you start getting rising house prices, because it's based on land values, as we were talking earlier. And as that goes ahead, there's a huge, what I call the inflationist block in the southeast of England, which makes its money on these boom and busts. So think of all of the estate agents and building contractors and all the rest of it. And so the economy picks up, these people make a packet as land values rise, then inevitably interest rates have to rise to stop the bubble
developing.
Which
they've been talking about doing this.
They're terrified of doing it, because even a small increase in interest rates may not just slow the economy, it will crash it because of the quantitative easing and all the rest of it. So they're getting themselves into the usual usual corner, and inevitably it will crash. And of course, places like Middlesbrough and Merthyr Tydfil and Blackpool are still seeing no benefit from the so-called boom at all, and so they never get off the ground. And this policy has been all of the investment, of course, goes into housing and bricks and mortar and speculation and land, instead of into building a better widget as it does in Germany or Scandinavia. And so we're constantly just going nowhere with it. What I would also suggest,
solutions, Martin, solutions.
Well, I'm very interested to hear what Ron's been saying
about
building. Well, I mean, one of the things you need to do actually is take existing houses and take them into public ownership and use them as public housing. We could wait forever to build a whole new generation of small houses. There's plenty of empty property out there, both commercial and non-commercial, and if we had a sufficient will, we would tackle this.
But it's interesting,
and turn them into social housing.
What Rob was saying is that the housing developers have got their permission to build houses. They're just sitting and waiting for prices to go up before.
Well,
what
you need for that is a land value tax, so if they hang on to it, they lose money. But of course, that requires legislation at central level.
I wonder whether that's what's happening in St. Paul's, because there's that enormous area of land which was demolished there, which is right, you know, where people need to live. Lovely to see some family homes. It was it's all controlled by Places for People, and we had all sorts of promises, whatever it was, 5 years ago, of skyscrapers with swimming pools on the top, which was some sort of, I don't know, fantasy used to lull the locals into some kind of, bemuse them really, in a way, and of course nothing whatsoever has happened.
Well, it's going back to what I said to you, you know, you get all manner of promises and issues, you get outline planning permission for something that's brilliant on paper. A brick doesn't go on a brick, but the value of the land with that is handed on to the next person, and they have to pay for that type of development and development potential. And so, you know, it's a vicious circle.
I wonder whether, Martin, some of these developers are concentrating on building out in the countryside, in the shires, luxury housing, and they're thinking, well, actually, these sort of three-bedroom houses in the inner city aren't really... don't cut the mustard when it comes to turning profit margins.
Well, I mean, but the phrase of the moment is affordable housing. So the Labour Party is promising to build 200,000 affordable houses if it wins the next election. Now, that doesn't mean social housing. It means affordable housing. And, of course, that allows the developers all sorts of scope to build basically housing for the people that get housed in this country, the people with some dosh. And of course the real problem is people with no money. And this has been fundamental. That's why there was massive council housing built in this country after the Second World War, because otherwise you have to live in slums. Poor people can't afford housing unless it is subsidised for them. And the whole free market philosophy just doesn't know how to deal with that, apart from letting people sleep in the street.
Anyway, it's...
Tony, before we leave this, just one other new initiative that I'm trying to push with George the Mayor and with the Labour Group's support. And that is that any land sales, any development monies, any regeneration grants that we get, currently is a bit of a lottery where that money goes. And with George, it's likely to go and rebuild the Georgian house. Not, sorry, Georgian house, the Dutch house, I'm afraid, in Corn Street. And I'm saying that any of that type of funding that comes into the city council should have 20-25% of that automatically ring fenced to build social housing.
Okay, Friday the 13th of October is today. Now, the interested, all sorts of people say various things about where this whole thing of Friday the 13th. I'm very lucky to have a show on a Friday because it does pop up every few months as a 13th. What are your thoughts, Ron or Martin, either of you, on where does this Friday the 13th come from, this superstition around it?
We've done this before, Tony. So I know your answer is it's to do with the Knights Templar and they're being taken down by Philip IV, I think it was. I actually, if you read the White Goddess by Robert Graves, Friday the 13th is the Freya's day, Freya being the goddess, the 13th being the goddess number, and it's unlucky from a patriarchal point of view. That's Robert Graves.
Okay, your thoughts, Ron, on Friday the 13th? Do you get superstitious on a Friday the 13th?
No, not at all. And to be honest, it's not an issue that's exercised very many of my few remaining grey cells.
Doesn't come up on the doorsteps too much, Tony.
No, it doesn't. That's because it was 1307. Yes, these are the charges of heresy against the Knights Templar. Now, the Templars were very interesting because they were supposedly a Christian order, and yet they were really the world's first ever multinational corporation. They were bankers. They used to move money around, and also
they were masons.
They killed a lot of people out in the Crusades, even actually sacking the Constantinople, which was supposed to be the head of the Holy Roman Empire at the time, or at least where, you know, it was a very important Christian city. Bizarre. But anyway, just a little bit of information about that, because we're told often that the evidence that these people were not Christians and doing some weird rites was extracted through torture. That is partly true, but it's also true that there were three whistleblowers. We like to hear about whistleblowers, and it's one of the things that I think nowadays we're told the government wants to have whistleblowers, and yet when someone does blow the whistle, often they're persecuted. I mean, a friend of ours, Annie Machon, former MI5 officer, and David Shelley were chased halfway around the world by the authorities, and David himself was taken to court. Even though the government's saying we want whistleblowers, when one appears, what happens to them? Very often, they are given the third degree, should we say. But anyway, Esquine of Floyan, Bernard Pellet, and Gerard of Beisel were three Templars who were whistleblowers. They weren't tortured. They gave the French king the evidence that he needed in order to put the Templars down, and there were 5,000 Templars who were arrested by Philip IV of France, as Martin quite rightly said, on Friday the 13th of October 1307. Which brings us on to the Freemasons and this story from last week about the former Tory mayor of Weston-super-Mare and vice chair of North Somerset Council, Philip Judd, who is admitted to these pornography charges. He's being charged next month. But let's leave these counts of possessing 151 films and 200 images of children and also taking some of these images. What are your thoughts about Freemasonry, Ron, and whether it should be on the list there when you sign up as a councillor?
Correct.
Or I believe as a councillor officer too, you're told we want to know what your outside interests are, please.
Well, if they got nothing to hide, why are they worried about declaring a membership? I mean, I've declared every single membership I've ever had, from the King Charles Spaniel Association to the National Road Society, etc., none of which clashes with the City Council. However, in relation to the Masons, I don't like the secrecy. I don't like the privilege that goes with it. I don't like the way in which they operate. I don't like the way in which they mutually support each other. Quite often in issues that are either very close to being illegal or indeed illegal. And when I was a parliamentary candidate twice, both in South Gloucester in the election there and against Liam Fox, I came up against the Freemasons using their power and ability and connections in both the police, the banking situation, in relation to the official receiver's office, where they're all in the same temple or whatever they
call it.
And what they were doing, again, was coming back to what we were saying before, which was picking on family businesses. Some were farmers. The second guy was a builder working out of Ashton, and they were trying to force them out of business, take over their land, develop that for housing, etc., and for profit.
Well, the obvious question is, how did you know that it was a Freemason doing this? Because, you know, obviously they do everything they can to keep their association
secret. In both cases, the individuals came to me in desperation because nobody would listen. But what was they were told when they said that they were going to complain about the treatment of the foreclosure on their current accounts, etc., by the banks, that police officers told them that, one, it was no point taking it any further, because the manager and the official receiver and anything in relation to crime, in relation to those issues, they were all in the same branch of the Masons.
Martin, what's your thought about this? I mean, surely it's a basic thing of probity. Any kind of organisation, particularly a secret society that you're part of, you should be declaring it if you're standing for public office.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And, of course, the Freemasons... I see Freemasons... If Freemasons didn't exist, then they would probably be created by those with power and wealth. And the propaganda duo in Italy was the Freemason Lodge at the heart of the Gladio operation run by NATO. So you've got the Mafia, the fascists and the intelligence services all in the same lodges, including the politicians, and they're involved in terrorism, money laundering, etc., all of which has been covered extensively in Posimato's book, La Repubblica dei Strani Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres. He's the head of the Italian Supreme Court. And it's not so much the Masons that's the problem. Propaganda Duo was a Freemason organisation, but was actually being instrumentalised by the CIA and other major intelligence agencies. And I think all secretive organisations can be used in that way. The Masons have a historical background of, you know, as we all know, the Paulson affair from the 60s and so on. Masonry has often been associated with local government corruption.
And also in the judiciary too. I can remember on a visit to the Masonic Lodge here in Bristol being pointed out to different magistrates who were, and they were actually only acting as little sort of foot soldiers standing to stop people going down the stairs, and they were being ordered around by other people. And you think, well, this is the weird thing about it. You've got magistrates who are supposed to be upstanding pillars of society, ordered around by who? Anyway, let's have a listen now to Jack Lopresti. He's a Freemason, he's an MP, and he had some stuff to say to me a couple of years ago about Freemasonry when he came on this show back in April 2012.
I think Freemasons generally for many years have realised now they are going to survive, society is changing, and they need to be more open, transparent, and they are. I mean, I'd be more than happy to arrange for you to go and visit Freemasons Hall in Bristol or one of the Freemasons Halls in South Gloucestershire, and you'll see, you know, it's a positive organisation which does a lot of good work for local charities.
I think one thing I might ask you is for the book, the little book for the Bristol Masonic book, which has got actually the names of who it is, because that's why people, I think, mostly question Freemasonry, because they don't know who the Masons are.
There are lots of organisations which don't publicise their membership, and that we can have a debate about, you know, how much that should be transparent. But if you want, I'll send you a copy.
Lovely.
Of that. It's interesting. It's like a play. You know, there's nothing remotely sinister about it. And with the internet, you can find out probably more about Freemasonry than the average Freemason would ever learn in his lifetime.
Okay. Now on to Phil.
So I'll send you the book and I'll arrange a visit.
Thank you, Jack.
Well, the book never turned up. In fact, I asked Jack several times for it, and Steve Rawlings, who was the secretary here in Bristol. No book and no visit either at the end of all that. So nothing much came of that. But anyway, Ron, in Wales, just across the Bristol Channel, every single person in public office has to declare this. There's a little box that says, are you a member of a secret society, like there was here for a couple of years in the 1990s. Why is it that in Britain, in England, we don't have this, but just over the water they do?
Well, I think there's been the ability to influence the, shall we say, the approach and the laws in England to be different from Wales. And I think it's a shame because, like I said, if they are, as Jack Lopresti has just claimed, working for charity, fine. But I think the only charity that they're working for, from what my experience has been over 29 years as a councillor, is it's all about self-promotion, self-protection, and indeed the ability to manipulate power at a local level and in secret. And that should not happen.
Okay, just one of the oaths that the third degree Freemasons swear, and Philip Judd was a Master Mason, so we'd have sworn this oath. It says, oh, that my throat had been cut across, my tongue torn out by its roots, and buried in the rough sands of the sea at low water mark, where the tide ebbs and flows twice in 24 hours. Ere I had been accessory to the death of so good a man as our Grand Master Hiram Abiff. Martin, just about P2, this Italian, just tell us, what did P2 actually achieve? It was really essentially a kind of secret parallel government in Italy, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, if you remember, Roberto Calvi was found hanging underneath Westminster Bridge with two bricks in his pocket. He was Vatican banker. Now, what Pope Francis has just
done... Can I just point out one thing about that? Because it was seen, recognised by many, to be a Masonic ritual murder, because what had happened to him was he was dangling, but as the tide came up, it went over his body and back again. And this is one of those oaths which I've just been spelling out there. Some recognise this,
well,
but
others
don't.
Well, what Pope Francis has just done is he's just completely sacked the people running the Vatican Bank and appointed a whole load of other people. Whether that will get to the bottom of all of this is another matter. P2 was absolutely essentially involved in Gladio, and we mentioned Gladio quite frequently on this show. People just need to do a web search and they will find what Gladio was. Gladio was essentially NATO's secret armies operating in Western Europe and possibly now in the Ukraine. They're involved in terrorism, money laundering, linkages between the mafia, the far right, fascist terrorists, and the intelligence services and the military. And this is not even disputed in Italy. As I said, Imposimato's book, which came out in 2012, covers all of this, and he is in fact the head of the Italian Supreme Court, and his information is based upon decades of investigation by the police force. Now, in other words, NATO, I haven't heard to stress this enough, NATO has a track record of provocational terrorism. Killed hundreds of people in Italy in the 70s and the 80s, and they're still doing it in the Ukraine today.
Okay, yes. I say about Philip Judd, this former mayor, Tory mayor from Weston-super-Mare, is due to be sentenced next month, is he was also in the Royal Engineers. And something that I know, actually, in a book about the army, I was quite surprised to read, was that everybody in the Army Council, every single member of it, had to be a Freemason traditionally in the Army. So, you know, I think there's also something else that needs saying here is obviously that not all Freemasons are evil people by any means. But what's happened is there's been a characteristic change in the organisation over the decades. Slowly but surely, this organisation that in many ways was benevolent as a kind of speakeasy place where people could speak their mind freely has changed its characteristics with much darker motives taking over many of these lodges. Anyway, on to some other news now, and let's go to Westminster and hear from the Prime Minister's questions, where the Labour leader Ed Miliband was asking David Cameron, Prime Minister, about the scandal up in Birmingham.
Mr. Ed Miliband.
Mr. Speaker, everybody will have been concerned about what has been happening at certain schools in Birmingham, including girls being forced to sit at the back of the class and the forced removal of head teachers. Mr. Speaker, at the heart of this story is a failure of accountability locally and nationally. But the key question for parents is this: if there is a serious problem at their school, where do they go to get it sorted out?
Well, first of all, let me echo what the Right Honourable Member has said about how important it is to get a grip of this issue. The problem of Islamist extremism in our schools is serious. The situation, not just in Birmingham but elsewhere this has happened, is extremely serious, and I am absolutely determined, as is the Home Secretary, as is the Education Secretary, indeed the whole government, to make sure this is unacceptable in our country. People should be being taught in our schools in a way that makes sure they can play a full part in the life of our country. Now, in terms of where you go to if you are concerned about what is happening in your school, the first place to go is to the head teacher and to the chair of governance. And while I hope we can forge real unity across the House of Commons on combating Islamist extremism in our schools, I hope that it isn't used as an agenda to try and knock down successful school formats, whether academies created under the last government or free schools created under this government.
Now, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I'll come to you first on this. What are your thoughts about the this whole scandal in Birmingham? Because we've had a bit of rivalry, haven't we, between Michael Gove, the Education Secretary, and Theresa May, the Home Secretary, about who is going to deal with this better. And there's quite a lot of feuding going on, it seems.
Well, that's because, in the first place, the extremism being talked about was real extremism. We're talking about terrorism, people being recruited as potential terrorists. And if we go back to the root of all of this, it's a document, the so-called Trojan Horse fax.
Oh, that's right. It was faxed in anonymously, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed. And it's quite clear that the investigations, four different investigations that have been kicked off by this, it's quite clear that that fax was forged by somebody. So somebody out there is trying to create trouble for the Muslim community.
What evidence is there that it's been forged then?
There's all sorts of aspects to the facts which show that it can't possibly be true. In other words, there's elements of fact in it that are wrong, and so on and so forth. So somebody has deliberately thrown a hand grenade into the situation to set all this off. And before we go on about what should or shouldn't happen in schools, let's go back like a laser to how this whole thing started. Because the Muslim community in Birmingham feels persecuted. I'm absolutely sure about that. They feel persecuted and picked on. Now, no doubt there are problems with schools and things that need to be looked at.
Well, Martin, if we go back a couple of years, do you remember they had a CCTV camera ring around a council estate where a lot of Muslims were living in, which was, there was actually no justification for whatsoever, a massive ring of steel of CCTV. And eventually they had to take the whole thing down because they realised there was absolutely no justification.
Well, no, what happened in that case, if you remember, was that they told the local community that this was all going to be to keep down street crime, but the funding for it came from the anti-terrorist squad, and it was actually an anti-terrorist operation. And eventually, of course, activists on the ground, both Muslim and non-Muslim, uncovered what was the funding stream
for that. So what I'm saying is, if Muslims in Birmingham are feeling persecuted, then there's a good reason for that.
Yes, and of course, we should also, when we're talking about terrorism, let's be absolutely clear. Operation Cyclone in the 1980s was the biggest undercover operation in history. It armed and trained Al-Qaeda to fight in Afghanistan. MI6 was the lead agency on that operation, which is why the French police used to call London Londonistan, because MI6 have actually got their fingers, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, for example, who they've been supporting to overthrow Gaddafi. They've been working with them for years and years and years. The linkages between Western intelligence services, particularly MI6 and extremist Islamist groups, is palpable.
But what's this got to do with Birmingham?
Well, because we started off by talking about extremism. Muslim extremism. Now let's talk about the history of Muslim extremism. Al-Majah Harun, quite likely a front organisation for the intelligence services. Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, definitely. Now, we're coming down to talk about schools and children and all the rest of it. But before we start talking about what should be happening in schools, let's just get this terrorism extremism thing sorted out. Because the root of that goes straight back into MI6 and the CIA, without a shadow of a doubt. The history is all there. Now, let's come to talk about what we're talking about schools here now. The real problem here is the education policy of successive governments of allowing, destroying local education authorities and comprehensive education and allowing any old body to set up a school. That's the problem. It shouldn't have been allowed. And personally, I'm in favour of having no religion in schools whatsoever. None whatsoever. And that doesn't mean I want to have in, like in France, where girls are not allowed to wear hijabs or whatever. I just don't think that religion is appropriate in school. And in Northern Ireland, it's caused immense problems. But both Tony Blair and the current government
religion in schools. Should be none. But I mean, let's remember how education started in this country. It was with church schools.
All right. Well, in that case, if we're going to allow religious schools, then there are going to be Muslim religious schools, just as there are Jewish religious schools and Christian religious schools.
Anyway,
and they're going to segregate girls because that's the sort of things that religious schools do.
Birmingham, particularly, there's been an Ofsted inspection which has been found to be pretty disastrous this week. And I think even an injunction this morning telling certain governors that they're not allowed onto school premises or they'll be arrested.
Yes, but I mean, these schools were all inspected last year and were all passed as absolutely outstanding. So the inspectors that then come in quite clearly with an agenda from the government. Michael Wilshaw and Ofsted are despised by teachers, I can tell you that. They're despised. I don't believe a word they say. I don't believe when they said last year the schools were outstanding. I don't believe now when they say that they're not. I just don't believe a word they say.
Okay, The Guardian, I think, would agree with you. Certainly some of the writers there, anyway, because they had an article in there this week, in fact, last weekend on Sunday, I guess it was The Observer, is the Trojan horse row just a witch hunt triggered by a hoax?
Yes, it is my answer to that. And it reminds me very much of those who've read history of the Popish plot of the 1600s, where Titus Oates invented loads of things that the Catholics were supposedly doing, and then everybody had an extremely hissy fit, and lots of people ended up being executed and burned, and so on. And I'm afraid societies are, in fact, prone to this kind of thing, especially when you've got the intelligence services in the background running the so-called extremist groups.
Okay, well, it sounds to me like what you're saying is some kind of Muslim baiting, rather like the Nazis Jew baiting.
You said it, Tony. I will just agree with you.
Anyway, okay, what are your thoughts on this, Ron?
Well, I'm not as au fait with the inner history of Middle Ages, etc., but I do think it throws up a number of issues, and particularly the operation or misoperation of Ofsted as a body. I would agree with Martin that Wilshaw is somebody that I've got no time for at all in relation to some of the issues that he's raised in local schools here in Bristol, unfairly in my view. However, I think it's amazing that, you know, as Martin pointed out, Ofsted came in and there was one report that said these are excellent schools, and then suddenly they're in special measures and everybody has got a problem and we have to deal with it. I do think it's quite difficult with some of the practices that go on or is required by the Muslim community, and this is not criticism of them, it's recognising their ability to practice their faith and community, and I respect that. But in cases such as in the council, for example, we have to provide areas for our Muslim workers to be able to go and pray, etc., and we respect that. But is that being blown out completely out of proportion in relation to what is required in relation to dress codes or what you can teach on the curriculum, etc.? And again, I think Martin is right that, you know, where we've moved away from state education with a very clear national curriculum and, if you like, a balanced or an attempt to balance approaches on all religious faiths and fronts, we've now got the ability for virtually anybody, if they've got the will, the expertise and the ability to find a building, to set up a school. And the current government seems to be pushing free schools at everybody on the basis of choice and abilities. And my concern is just how, can I say, critical is to look at the staff in the curriculum and what is being taught. And
one of the things that has amazed me about this is that there's been very little criticism of it from the mainstream press, apart from this excellent article in The Guardian by Richard Adams. I mean, he's talking about, as Martin said, four separate inquiries having been set up, and he says, what's remarkable is how the Trojan Horse affair has got bigger and bigger, from a flimsy letter involving a handful of schools, which is full of errors, the Inner City Birmingham, to a scandal that engulfs the cabinet and all the political parties.
Well, indeed, it reminds me of it's a very sinister development, and the overreaction to this is what's shocking. And don't forget that the Tory party are trying to look to their right now, because they've got UKIP barking at their ankles. And all of this stuff is creating... If you were to think about it, all of this negative publicity about Muslims in schools in Birmingham, it could lead a youngster to decide that the people of Britain don't care about Islam and that they don't care about Muslims, and perhaps they ought to going off to Syria, perhaps, to fight for Islam. Although, of course, we do want Assad overthrown, and we are actually supplying weaponry to the people trying to overthrow
it. It could be a recruitment tool for Al-Qaeda.
Indeed, but as I said to you earlier, Al-Qaeda has, insofar as it exists, is a creation of the Western intelligence services.
Okay, also,
there was any dispute about that.
Worth mentioning, of course, the Trojan Horse, the Chief Constable and the Police Commissioner in Birmingham have both attacked the appointment of a former anti-terror chief. They were outspoken enough to say, well, this is completely the wrong guy for the job. Government decision to appoint a former anti-terror chief to investigate allegations of the hardline Islamic takeover has been heavily criticised by the region's top cop. Education Secretary Michael Gove earlier announced that Peter Clark, who served as head of Metropolitan Police Counter-Terrorism Unit, was to become Education Commissioner with responsibility to investigate these allegations.
Absolutely absurd. And you can see what sort of message is being sent by that. So we've got a school inspection that's going to be headed by a former anti-terrorist police officer. Now, if that's not picking on the community, what is? And the local cops, to their great credit, have said, what are you playing at? Because, of course, they're doing their best to get to work with the community to keep extremism under control. And this sort of thing encourages extremism, doesn't it? It sort of gives give a dog a bad name and he'll stick to it.
Okay, on back to Westminster now then, and we're going to hear now from our local MP from Kingswood. That's a Tory, Chris Skidmore. I've asked him probably 15 times on this show and he's not managed to respond, only to say no occasionally, and most of the time you don't get any response at all. But anyway, we're going to hear from him now, where he was asking about unemployment and the fact that unemployment is down in Kingswood at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday.
Mr. Chris Skidmore.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Today's employment figures show that unemployment in Kingswood is down by 37% since May 2010. And as the local MP for Kingswood, since 2012 I've held 8 jobs fairs advertising hundreds of local jobs. Just some of the 2 million private sector jobs that's been created since this government. But there is still more to do. Together with the Kingswood Job Centre, I'm launching the Kingswood Challenge today, a mentoring or job fostering scheme where local business leaders will be paired with local people looking for work, helping to provide them with one-to-one support.
Can I thank my honourable friend for what he's doing in terms of these job fairs to put people who want work in touch with businesses? And this is absolutely key, because there is no complacency on this side of the House about unemployment whatsoever. Youth unemployment, long-term unemployment, we still need to remove these scourges from our country. We have a goal of full employment, and the way we'll achieve that goal is not simply through a growing economy, now growing faster than other countries in the G7, but also by making sure we help people, train people, and give them all that's necessary to get on and get a job and have that security and stability in their lives.
Well, good news anyway from Kingswood, Ron. 2 million private sector jobs, and Kingswood's taking its share. Some good news for a change on the employment front.
Well, is it? Because my understanding is that a lot of people that were originally on the unemployment register have given up on trying to find a job, and have been forced virtually to try to start some form of home operation or work for themselves, or be self-employed. And there's no guarantee that those are actually going to function and carry through and give them a stable and constant income.
You mean going on to tax credits, which then they move and they may be trying to start a business,
yeah.
Which might be
selling things on eBay, for example, that kind of thing. And whilst they're trying to start a business, for that period of a year or so, they're given a little bit of period of grace by the tax authorities, but at which point they will then come and try and get those tax credits back if they haven't actually been able to get their business going. But then, of course, that year then gives the work programme people who have been putting them on the, onto these schemes the chance to claim their £15,000 or whatever it is for getting one long-term unemployed person off the dole. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's, it's pretty clear that some there is a bit of massive financial incentive to put people onto the tax credit schemes that they don't, where they can't actually make a living.
Yeah, exactly. That's my concern. So I'm not saying there hasn't been some improvements or there's been some initiatives that's been able to create employment, and obviously that is welcome, but I'm afraid that, again, after 29 years of being a councillor, the way in which national statistics are either compared or presented, or what factors are actually included or excluded, you can make figures say anything you like. And let's face it, the Tories are in the hole and can't see out the top of it at the minute, and they're just grabbing any straw possible to try to say that their way of austerity is working, but also to try and combat, if you like, the attacks of other parties.
Martin?
Yeah, well, I think I read not long ago that Kingswood, in fact, in Britain, has got the highest number of people on zero-hours contracts. So he didn't mention that in his little presentation to the Prime Minister, did he? I think I agree with what Ron was saying. A lot of these figures are fiddled. Basically, people are being pushed. The dodges change over the years.
Yeah.
But this is the new dodge now, is to put people, call people self-employed who are effectively unemployed, but they're called self-employed.
Yeah, or job-seeking.
Or job-seeking.
Well, quite one of the things that they're encouraged to do, actually, is to actually sell their possessions on eBay.
Yes, indeed. But the other thing I'd point out, underlying all of this, is we've had quantitative easing and virtually zero interest rates for 5 years. And if at the end of that, all you can get is a little bit of spurt of zero-hours contracts, underpinning all of this is the fact that the banking system is bust, that we've got a property bubble blowing up, which will have to be dealt with by raising interest rates. So it's all rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. And I'm afraid the next Labour government is going to face the consequences of hitting the iceberg. But, of course, the iceberg is there, and we're going to hit it.
We've also been hearing about the recovery, and Pamela Nash asked a question about that, at Prime Minister's questions.
Pamela Nash.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. In Scotland alone, since this Prime Minister took office, the number of people reporting to have been forced into using loan sharks has went up 57%. In fact, it's estimated there's a total of 85,000 people in Scotland in this predicament. Can I ask the Prime Minister what his government is going to do about this, or does he think that this is acceptable?
On this issue, look, there's a series of issues that honourable members quite rightly raise that we need to properly tackle to make sure that we help everyone in our country benefit from economic recovery. On the minimum wage, which was declining when I became Prime Minister, it is now increasing. On zero-hours contract, nothing done under the last government, now legislation to get rid of exclusivity. On payday lending, nothing done in the last 13 years, now being properly regulated with a cap on payday lending. Yeah. On minimum wage, we've also made sure that the penalties for not paying the minimum wage have been quadrupled under this government. I'm absolutely determined to make sure that everyone who wants to work hard and do the right thing can benefit from the economic recovery now underway.
Yeah, well, I mean, Mr Cameron there, Martin, absolutely adamant that there's the economic recovery is in overdrive now.
Well, he would say that, wouldn't he? Also, he was saying our commitment to full employment. Unemployment in this country is still 2.7 million. I can remember when it went over a million in the 1970s and people were shocked and horrified.
Absolutely right. And if that's what David Cameron believes is happening, I can't see proof of it out in my ward or locally.
Okay, thanks, Ron. Time for the Murdoch News at 6. That was Ron Stone, Labour councillor for St George West. After the Murdoch News, the police and the Lib Dems.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM.